cemetery. Carve their names in headlines and gravestones they would never know in the kitchens of this cacophonous world. Enter their names in the book of names. Say Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez. Say Angie Valeria Martinez Avalos. Bury them in a corner of the cemetery named for the sainted Archbishop of the Poor, shot in the heart saying Mass, bullets bought by the taxes I paid when I worked as a bouncer and fractured my hand 40 years ago, and bumper stickers read, El Salvador is Spanish for Vietnam. When the last bubble of breath escapes the body, may the men who speak of floaters, who have never seen floaters this clean, float through the clouds to the heavens, where they paddle the air as they wait for the saint who flips through the keys in his ring like a drowsy janitor till he fingers the key that turns the lock and shuts the gate on their babble-tongued faces, and they plunge back to earth, a shower
Martinez,
of hailstones pelting
them. Thank you so much.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 5 o'clock. Coming up is the evening news. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Natural Grocers, which is donating 2.5% of company-wide sales this Martin Luther King Day to the Jack and Jill Gap Fund for Historically Black Colleges and Universities.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday at 4:30 p.m.
I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
I'm Shahid Hamid, KBOO board member. Join the World Arts Foundation and KBOO Radio as we pay homage to the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It's the 35th anniversary of Keep Alive the Dream, Monday, January the 20th, from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center. This year, we will be joined by international opera star Angela Brown and straight from America's Got Talent, Danielle Damon. That's Monday, January the 20th, from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center at 7600 Northeast Gleason. Or listen live on KBOO Radio or view it on Open Signal Community Television.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, 100 rare books were stolen from a Portland bookstore.
A Wisconsin Court of Appeals has blocked a state voter roll purge.
And in international news, smoke from the bushfires in Australia is expected to make a circuit around the world.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 14th, 2020. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Over 100 rare books were stolen from a Northeast Portland bookstore the night of January 1st. At least one person broke into Passage's bookshop that night. The thieves broke glass display cases filled with hundreds of rare edition books. Passage's bookshop is located on Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. The store specializes in unusual and rare books, focusing on poetry, art, and literature. The books stolen on January 1st included first editions, rare books, and even signed copies. Passage's owner, David Abel, suspects the thieves will try to sell the books and has notified other local bookshop owners. Passage's was forced to close for 2 weeks, but plans to reopen this Thursday. The owner hopes that insurance will cover some of the damages. Abel says he has gotten an outpouring of community support since the break-in, including fundraising offers. A list of the stolen books is available on Passage's website online. Those who have information on the burglary are encouraged to contact the Portland Police Bureau.
A right-wing activist who was charged with assault in Portland plans to plead guilty for his role in the violent altercation. 23-year-old Tusitala Toesi, who goes by Tiny, is facing felony and misdemeanor assault charges in Multnomah County after prosecutors said he and an associate, Donovan Flippo, beat a man during a June 2018 confrontation in northeast Portland. Toesi and Flippo are both members of the Proud Boys, a right-wing fraternal organization. Flippo pled guilty over the summer to fourth-degree assault. Toesi also gained notoriety as a member of Patriot Prayer, another right-wing group based in Vancouver. He served as one of Patriot Prayer leader Joey Gibson's closest confidants until the two had a falling out. In October, Toesi was jailed for 10 days in Multnomah County after he violated his probation on a harassment conviction stemming from a fight at a December 2017 demonstration in downtown Portland. Stay tuned after this newscast at 5:30 for an in-depth interview with Tim Ledwith, the man who was originally assaulted by Toesi and Flippo in June of 2018.
The Salem City Council voted unanimously on Monday to draft an emergency declaration allowing legal car camping in certain areas. Many community members who spoke at the council meeting supported the push for car camping, but added that more still needs to be done to help the city's houseless population. The legalization of car camping is one piece of a proposed emergency resolution, which could also designate the city-owned Pringle Hall as a temporary shelter and would allow for an increase in the capacity of the newly opened Safe Sleep Women's Shelter from 10 to 19 beds. Safe Sleep staff say they regularly have to turn away women once the shelter reaches capacity. City officials said that Pringle Park has the space to shelter 37 people overnight. A temporary shelter at the hall is currently not allowed, but the emergency declaration would waive the city zoning requirements and allow the building to be used as a shelter until March 31st. The Salem City Councilors voted to draft an emergency declaration that would declare a housing crisis. The council is expected to vote again on the order during their meeting on January 21st. The houseless population in Salem is around 1,800 people. One city councilor, Chris Hoy, said car camping is not the single solution, but rather one component to helping people find a legal, sheltered place to sleep.
Facebook chose the small town of Tierra del Mar, Oregon, as the landing spot for its undersea cable connecting Asia to North America. But the town did not choose Facebook back. KABU reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu has this story.
Residents of a small coastal Oregon town are continuing to fight Facebook's plan to install a landing spot for the tech giant's undersea cable. Tierra del Mar is an unincorporated city in Tillamook County that's so small it doesn't have cell phone service or fire hydrants. Facebook's cable would help connect Asia to North America. Cameron La Follette, head of the Oregon Coast Alliance, says Tierra del Mar is a rural, residential area, and Tillamook County ordinances allow land use installations similar to a public utility.
This is not similar to a public utility. The citizens of Tillamook County are not going to benefit from this cable. Facebook has made that clear in their testimony. They just want to place the landing there because it's convenient.
The Tillamook County Board of Commissioners approved Facebook's plan last week in a vote of 2-1. La Follette says residents have 21 days to appeal the decision to the Land Use Board of Appeals. A Facebook spokesperson says the company has engaged with the community over the past year and addressed concerns about noise, environmental impact, and road closures. At the Board of Commissioners meeting, the company said drilling for the landing will last for about a month, and all that will remain is a manhole cover. La Follette says residents are still concerned about the disturbance drilling will make. She also notes there's a larger concern that this could open the door for other companies that could pick a spot anywhere along the Oregon coast to land their undersea cables.
Facebook or another submarine cable company could do the same thing elsewhere and cite as precedent, they let us do it in Tillamook County at Tierra del Mar. Everybody recognizes the precedential value of this very ugly decision.
La Follette also would like to see state lawmakers and the governor's office address this issue. This is KABU reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu in collaboration with Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service. Last night, Metro Regional Government held a public comment meeting about its proposed transportation funding package for the November 2020 ballot. The multi-billion dollar investment would focus on corridors in the region, major thoroughfares that are smaller than freeways. A notable investment would be made in the Southwest Corridor, where TriMet hopes to build a MAX line connecting Southwest Barber Boulevard with Tigard. KABU's S.J. Oxendine was at the meeting and got a chance to catch up with some of the attendees about their priorities for Metro Regional Transportation.
Hi, this is Jason Snyder. I'm the mayor of the city of Tigard.
All right.
And I am here to testify and did testify to the council about how we are generally supportive of the approach that Metro's taken and the projects that are in line to be funded in the transportation measure in 2020. We definitely support the Southwest Corridor, which we feel is a critical project for our community in Tigard and Southwest area of Washington County and Multnomah County. We also have some concerns and gave feedback to the Metro Council tonight about the fact that Highway 99W should be included at least for study in the T2020 transportation package. So that was what I was speaking about tonight.
Okay. How is all of this about to be funded? How does this, for the people who wonder where the dollars come from, will there be a new tax raise, or how exactly will all this work?
Well, that's a great question, and one that the Metro Council still has to work through. They've been studying that. Their first step in the process was to figure out and identify which projects needed to be done, the highest priority, and figure out how much those would cost, and then figure out how to fund that. I anticipate that the funding for these projects will be done in a variety of different ways that may include various different funding mechanisms and potentially some additional taxes. Pedestrian and bike connectivity is something that we generally support, and our goal in the city of Tigard, our vision is to be the most walkable community in the Pacific Northwest, and part of that is making sure that you've got pedestrian and bike facilities.
And where exactly would you say we are in the process of getting all this done?
We're at the point of the Metro Council deciding what projects will and won't be included in the measure that is moving forward, or plan to move forward in November. I anticipate it'll be on the ballot in November of 2020.
Yes, my name is Paul Savas. I'm a Clackamas County Commissioner, and I'm here today advocating for full funding of the Sunrise Corridor. The reason is that it's an important gateway infrastructure needed to build the housing and provide the transportation infrastructure we need, both for transit, multimodal, cars, trucks, freight, and so on, in order to let that area of the county develop. Metro brought that property into the county 20 years ago, 13,000 acres, and we have yet to have the highway built. It's been on the books for decades, and we're trying to move this project, and at the time is critical. Now, with housing and people going homeless, it's critical that we build this and make that property and area available for housing. Well, the argument right now, which I somewhat agree with, is that there's a lack of housing, so therefore, with the lack of housing, people that are moving here with more income levels, higher income levels, are outpricing people with lower income levels to meet the rising rents, so that market pressure depends on more supply. So we have actually the highest amount of land available for housing, but it's sitting there, again, not served by the critical infrastructure, such as highway. So by building the housing out there, that will reduce the cost or the spike or the rapid rise of rents due to those market pressures. Supply and demand.
My name's Terry Parker. I live in Northeast Portland. My concern is that the same people are paying for this and the same people are exempt. They want to saddle the automobile owners and the property owners with the tax to pay for it, while the bicyclists and the transit riders are exempt, and yet they are going to be the primary beneficiaries of this. And then the other thing that I was very concerned about is when they remove traffic lanes on streets, it creates more congestion, it creates more fuel consumption, and it creates more emissions. And that's what this these projects appear to want to do, is remove traffic lanes, which will do all of this, and replace them with bus lanes and bike lanes. And the public in January of last year has said in Metro survey that they want more capacity for motorists, not less. And more capacity in certain places will help with the emissions and the fuel consumption.
Hi, my name is Jesse Lopez. I'm with the Portland 350 PDX Transportation Justice Team. I just gave testimony in support of a number of the proposed plans for the Metro 2020 bond, including investment in underserved communities, investment in mass transit, and investment in safety. And we criticized investment in auto-focused infrastructure, particularly at 82nd and Airport Way. And instead, we recommend that Metro support the recommendations put forward by the Getting There Together Coalition to support bus and rail options. Yeah, so specifically, the idea is right now the MAX has a single rail, a single line from to the airport, and so it's at grade, which means that there's conflict between the train and the cars, so that they have to share time at this intersection. Okay. So our idea is, instead of building an overpass for cars, build an overpass for the train instead, so that you're prioritizing the train users and folks that are getting to work and flying by train, and to add an additional train line so that you can run trains more frequently to and from the airport, and also to extend bus 72 along 82nd all the way to Airport Way, so folks can take 82nd via bus and not have to go transfer to Gateway and all the way around to the airport. A lot of the funding that's proposed now would go into building flyovers for vehicles. It would mm-hmm. it would add additional vehicle travel lanes okay. and flyovers. So it would make the Airport Way basically more like a highway, a typical interstate. So we're saying there's enough capacity there as it is now, but if you want to reduce that conflict between the trains essentially and the road, you can just build a overpass for the trains and build another line so that it's better served at the airport.
My name is Michaela Bishop. I am a member of Sunrise Hub PDX. I'm part of the Sunrise Movement. I'm 21 years old. I'm a student at Portland State University, and I showed up tonight to oppose any car-fueled corridor investments and to try to support fare-free transit, as it's suggested by Opal and a ton of other great organizations.
This is S.J. Oxendine reporting for KBOO Radio.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances with KBOO's Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. Then at 6, it's Preference, and at 7, Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 30 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 43 degrees. Today in history, in 1943, Franklin D. Roosevelt becomes the first president to travel on official U.S. business by airplane. FDR flew to Casablanca, Morocco, to see Winston Churchill for a World War II strategy meeting. The quote of the day is from Franklin D. Roosevelt, who said, quote, "No business which depends for existence on paying less than living wages to its workers has any right to continue in this country. By living wages, I mean more than a bare subsistence level. I mean the wages of a decent living," end quote.
Seventeen children were injured after a Delta flight dumped fuel over a Los Angeles school playground. Delta Flight 89 to Shanghai experienced an engine issue shortly after departing from Los Angeles International Airport for China. In response, the jetliner dumped fuel and returned to LAX. The Los Angeles Unified School District said, quote, "Students and staff were on the playground at the time and may have been sprayed by fuel or inhaled fumes." According to the Los Angeles County Fire Department, at least 17 children and 9 adults at Park Avenue Elementary were treated for minor injuries after being exposed to jet fuel. Another 16 people from Jordan High School and 93rd Elementary were also being treated for exposure to jet fuel. No one needed to be transported from the schools to a hospital, and there were no evacuation orders in place. The school district confirmed that students and staff were being treated for skin irritation or breathing problems after being exposed to the jet fuel.
A Wisconsin Court of Appeals blocked a ruling on Tuesday that would have purged 200,000 names from the voter rolls. Purging voter rolls involves removing voter registrations based on evidence that they no longer live in their registered area. Voters who did not respond to mail from election officials were planned to be dropped from the rolls. Wisconsin is considered a key player in deciding the 2020 election, with Trump narrowly winning the state in 2016. The appeals court ruling is considered a win for liberal groups who believe that the voter roll purge was simply a ploy to remove voters that would have supported Democrats. The original lawsuit challenging the voter rolls was brought by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. The conservative law group said it was seeking to ensure election integrity and maintain accurate voter lists. A state elections commission will have its first meeting this Tuesday to discuss the removal of the 200,000 names. The commission is made up of 3 Republicans and 3 Democrats and has been deadlocked over this issue in the past.
New Jersey Senator Cory Booker drops out of the race for the Democratic nomination, and tonight is the last Democratic primary debate before the Iowa caucuses. With more on the story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
I can't wait to get back on the campaign trail and campaign as hard as I can for whoever is the eventual nominee and for candidates up and down the ballot.
New Jersey Senator Cory Booker ended his bid for the Democratic nomination yesterday. He's up for re-election in the Senate and has kept his home community close throughout the year-long presidential campaign.
I was driven into politics not because of any kind of individual ambition. In fact, it was people in my neighborhood, the neighborhood that I still live in. When I was a tenants' rights lawyer, they said, look, we can make a bigger difference if you go to City Hall. And that's what began my career. Life is about purpose, not position. And my life purpose is to deal with these issues that are affecting communities like mine and, frankly, a lot of communities in Iowa as well.
Booker made news towards the end for pointing out the dwindling diversity in the Democratic primary, especially after California Senator Kamala Harris's exit.
It is a problem that we now have an overall campaign for the 2020 presidency that has more billionaires in it than black people.
There are still 3 non-white candidates in the race, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, Andrew Yang, and Hawaii Representative Tulsi Gabbard. But none will be at tonight's last Democratic debate before the Iowa caucuses, where there will be one billionaire, Tom Steyer. In addition to healthcare and the economy, we'll hear about Iran, the president's looming impeachment trial, and climate change, with massive bushfires in Australia, devastating floods in Indonesia, and earthquakes in Puerto Rico. Gabbard talked about what the people of Puerto Rico have been going through.
We need to get them power. We need to make sure they've got clean water, food, and medicine. And we've got to move with a sense of urgency to help them survive these natural disasters.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and former Vice President Joe Biden have drawn stark contrasts between their foreign policy approaches in past debates, and likely will tonight. Biden promotes his decades-long experience in the international arena, while Sanders, his staunchly anti-war record.
So important to elect someone who's already ready on day one when they're elected to pick up the pieces of this disarray and immediately be a commander-in-chief of our armed forces.
When I voted against the war in Iraq in 2002, I feared that it would result in greater destabilization in that country and in the entire region. Today, 17 years later, that fear has unfortunately turned out to be a truth.
Reports of, quote, a fraying non-aggression pact, unquote, between friends and competitors, Sanders and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, were denied by Sanders, who said of his employees, quote, people sometimes say things that they shouldn't, unquote, according to CNN. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
A therapist testifies at the water hearing about the Keystone XL pipeline's potential impact on women, and a judge rules that Wisconsin County violated federal Indian law in a zoning dispute with the tribe. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A therapist and activist from the Yankton Sioux Tribe testified Monday on the potential impacts on women if the Keystone XL pipeline is built. The South Dakota Water Management Board is holding hearings to determine whether to allow water use for the pipeline project. Victoria Wicks has more.
Faith Spotted Eagle says girls and women are targets for violence, and those in rural areas and on reservations are particularly vulnerable. If the pipeline is built, she says large crews of primarily transient men will come through sparsely populated areas of western South Dakota.
And we tell our girls, with these thousands of men from other places that are coming in, even if they are from South Dakota, there's tension between white and native people.
Spotted Eagle also wants to preserve the history of indigenous women when they stayed by the water, combining the spiritual with the mundane.
We had to be near the water to cook. We had to be near the water to do ceremony. We need to be near the water to take care of our children and keep people clean.
Spotted Eagle says ancient sites remain today along rivers where women performed ceremonies and construction could destroy them. During pregnancy, women carry babies in water in their wombs, and so Spotted Eagle is afraid water contaminated by tar sands oil will harm the unborn, the future generations.
It's like it affects my baby. It affects my child, my grandchildren, and any birth defects, any contamination that will occur in the womb, the first medicine.
The Water Management Board is holding hearings to determine if there's enough water for TC Energy to use and whether the water use is beneficial, serves a public interest, and does not impose on the rights of existing water users. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department has sent its final environmental study on the Keystone XL pipeline to the Environmental Protection Agency for review. The Trump administration approved the pipeline in 2017, reversing President Obama's 2015 denial of a permit. Tribes and environmentalists immediately sued, and a judge put an injunction on pipeline construction in late 2018, saying the new permit was based on an old study that was no longer valid. The State Department has issued a final supplemental environmental impact statement with public comments ending January 21st. A federal judge has ruled a northern Wisconsin county violated federal Indian law when it enforced its zoning rules on land owned by tribal members within a Lake Superior tribe's reservation. Danielle Kading reports.
The Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa sued Bayfield County in 2018. Tribal officials say members were threatened with fines for violating the county's zoning rules. Tribal Chairman Rick Peterson says Red Cliff has the right to govern its members and lands as a sovereign nation.
We do not want a bad relationship with any municipality, any other governmental agency. But at the same time, we are not going to allow any of these other municipalities to infringe upon our sovereign right here in Red Cliff.
The county has argued certain lands on the reservation fell under state jurisdiction, but the judge ruled Congress has not clearly given counties such zoning authority. An appeal of the ruling may follow. A lawyer representing the county declined to comment. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
A two-day U.S. presidential forum focusing on Native issues kicked off Tuesday in Las Vegas. The agenda includes broadband, the census, and key issues to Nevada tribes. Five candidates have confirmed their participation, according to the group Four Directions, which is hosting the event. The forum is being streamed online at nativevote2020.com. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Scientists at NASA are warning that smoke from the bushfires in Australia is expected to make at least one full circuit around the world. The smoke has already moved halfway around the globe, covering South America in haze and causing colorful sunrises. The smoke will eventually make a complete circuit, returning to Australia. The fires are even causing pyrocumulonimbus or pyro-CB events, which the space agency describes as, quote, essentially fire-induced thunderstorms. Colin Seftor, a staff scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, said that, quote, some of the Australian pyro-CB events have rivaled the largest values ever recorded. In Australia, the fires have killed at least 25 people and more than 1 billion animals.
Spike Lee has made history by becoming the first black jury head for the Cannes Film Festival. Lee, who has directed films such as Malcolm X and Do the Right Thing, said he was, quote, shocked, happy, surprised, and proud, unquote. Lee has premiered 7 films at the festival, with his 2018 movie Black Klansman receiving wide critical acclaim. The Cannes Film Festival's official statement said films by Lee, quote, brought the questions and contentious issues of the times to contemporary cinema. Spike Lee's perspective is more valuable than ever. Cannes is a natural homeland and a global sounding board for those who reawaken minds and question our stances and fixed ideas, unquote. Lee will also be awarded an honorary Palme d'Or Award for Lifetime Achievement.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 14th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is XASJ Oxendine and Annie Marr. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Ted Jones. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Sam Bowman. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. Host Paul Rowland interviews D. Victoria Baranetsky, Reveal Radio's legal counsel. At 9, it's Radio Zine. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Food Show, news and issues surrounding the food on your plate. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Good night, Yasmin.
Good night, Sam.
Thank you again for listening to Totality of Circumstances. You can catch us again in 2 weeks on Tuesday, the 28th of January at 5:30 p.m. here on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, your community radio station. Thank you for listening to KBOO Community Radio. My name is Sam Bowman, and this is Totality of Circumstances, a biweekly segment that focuses on policing, police community relations, the larger criminal justice system, and local activism, all from a community-based perspective. And this week, we're going to be focusing on a case that we covered in some detail not quite a year ago, in March of 2019, which has been going on since the middle of 2018, when Tusitala Tiny Toesi and Donovan Flippo, two Proud Boys and members of Patriot Prayer and just general right-wing brawlers, men who have been fixtures at many of the violent protests that have taken place in Portland over the past 3 to 4 years, they assaulted a Portland man named Tim Ledwith, who, full disclosure, is a coworker of mine. The case has gone on pretty much since then, with a big interruption before it really heated up in the beginning of 2019. Tiny today, just this morning, pled guilty to misdemeanor assault against Ledwith in Multnomah County Circuit Court. He was sentenced to 2 years of probation, essentially to time served, 80 hours of community service. 80 years would be nice. And he is required to pay restitution to Mr. Ledwith, who has medical bills still from the assault against him. And this comes a couple of months after Donovan also pled guilty. And as we'll hear Tim describe it, it's two very different courtroom experiences. During Donovan's sentencing hearing, there were many Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer members in attendance. And this was a much more subdued hearing this morning. We'll hear all about that in a minute. I spoke this afternoon with Tim Ledwith for a while, and we will put a longer version of this interview up on the web. And not long after we spoke back in March of last year, around the time that Tiny and Donovan were indicted, not long after that, Tiny fled to Samoa and he was there for several months outside the reach of the American justice system. And he came back in October and was arrested at Portland International Airport, booked into Multnomah County Jail. And that's essentially the time that he wound up serving in jail for the assault against Ledwith. Without further ado, I spoke to Tim Ledwith today about how this case has wrapped up and how it compares to some other cases that are pending against anti-fascists who often squared off with Toesi and Donovan and their ilk at these violent events that Patriot Prayer brought into Portland. And again, you can find a longer version of this interview online at kboo.fm. I am sitting here with Tim Ledwith. Tim, how are you doing today?
I'm all right.
And so we spoke back in, I think it was March of last year, about your, and correct me if I'm characterizing this wrong, your ongoing case against Tiny and Donovan with the Proud Boys.
Tiny Tusitala Toesi and Donovan Flippo. Yeah, I think last time we talked was shortly after they were, like, indicted and awaiting. I don't know, had Tiny fled the...
I don't think he had fled to Samoa at that point.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, yeah, so lots happened since then. Yeah, it's not really... characterizing it as my case...
Yeah, I didn't know if...
Well, I mean, it's... There's only so many words for how... Well, just to go over it again, I guess maybe, like, I was assaulted by them back in June of 2018 on the street. It's not at a protest. It was just at Safeway.
Yeah, like on Broadway?
Yeah, like across the street, like in that little, like, 12th in Broadway. I initially didn't press charges. I kind of walked away from the scene. I had to go to the hospital. I was slightly concussed, and I had a I had to get stitches in my mouth and stuff. So I ended up going to the police because there was a similar incident with an African American youth up in Vancouver, Washington, with them, and
with Tiny
Donovan and Russell Schultz, yeah, who was also involved with the, but didn't get charged or even talked to, but he was driving their truck. They assaulted this kid and put in the video online too, and the kid was charged with a felony. So it was put to me that if I did press charges, they could establish a pattern of their violence, because their violence was definitely escalating at that time, like just at protests, and then it was escalating to outside of them. The thing of it was that, like, I knew who they were, and I had been involved in, you know, I had marches and stuff like that, and countering their far right violence and bullying and stuff around town, but they didn't know who I was. So essentially, you know, when this gets framed in, like, a political context, it's kind of, I mean, there's definitely a part to it. Obviously, that's how I knew who they were, but they didn't know who I was. And essentially why I was assaulted was my reaction to, you know, being called slurs from a truck and threatened, which I think that platform being against that can go across the political spectrum. So that's a little context for what happened. So they were arrested at the beginning of the really sort of violent clash that happened on June 30th when they had a lot of people come to town from around the country. This is of 2018. And so they were arrested at the beginning of that rally, and then they were pretty much immediately released, and the case was dismissed. They called me once, I think the DA's office did. And at that point, because I wasn't really inclined to go to the police or deal with it or have really much faith in the justice system as it is, my objectives had been met at that point, because the kid had actually had this case drop and was a direct result from me pressing the charges.
The Vancouver kid.
Yeah. So
it was,
yeah. But what was messed up? Yeah. What was messed up was that, like, they didn't, like, the police or the DA's office rather didn't know that I felt that way. Like, as far as they knew, I was a cooperating witness, and I did even call them back. So it just sort of more validated my feelings on how it seemed like they were being treated versus, people on the anti-fascist side, just how, you know, the heavy-handedness at protests, and it just seemed the coziness with law enforcement. And then also, too, like, Tiny at this time, like, was just on a rampage. He was going around. I mean, as time went on, you know, more assaults would be, you would see them on videos. I mean, like, he around the country. I mean, he went to Rhode Island with with guys from I think it was Refuse Marxism and American Vanguard, like former like Nazi bonehead type dudes, and just there's a footage of him unprovoked just punching people. He's punched women. He's punched, you know, it's always someone a lot smaller than him too. Also in Austin, Texas, he actually just assaulted out of nowhere like two African American males who were wearing Obama T-shirts. They didn't even do it. Like it was so. And then here in Portland later on in that fall I think it was in December, there's footage of him brutally stomping like somebody in a when they crashed the march or no they crashed a memorial for someone who had been killed by the police when a fight broke out in front of Kelly's Olympian. You can see in this footage, there's even clearer footage that Andy Ngo took, but Curiously, Andy cut it out of his footage, but other people have footage of, and it clearly shows Tiny like stomping somebody on the ground who's being kicked by multiple people. He was doing all this, and it just at that point validated my what I felt about with law enforcement. Then the texting scandal happened. And that's where we were at, where I was at last time, because then the Willamette Week, because he was mentioned in that texting situation about seeming to get preferential treatment by the cop there in Voltnaya.
And almost being like warned.
Yeah, warned. Yeah,
had a warrant.
Because he had other situations. He was already on probation, that which he wasn't fulfilling and stuff. So the Willamette Week records requested all the case files for mine because it had been dismissed, so they could do that. And it just showed that they admitted to it, and they also had like video footage, not of the actual, so directly afterwards when they were like menacing me. They had two witnesses. They had someone that called 911, just a stranger. They had like, they had a lot of evidence, including themselves admitting to doing it. So, out of nowhere, right before that gets published, I get a call from the DA, and the DA says, we just happen to be going over your case, you know. So that's the context for that. They were indicted on felony assault charges, and shortly after that, because I think before the indictments were issued, when they were still secret, there was a really lively public hearing at that church with the mayor and the chief of police about the texting listening session. Yeah, the listening session. Yeah,
Maranatha.
And during that listening session, I kind of let the cat out of the bag, I guess. And then so that was reported on, and then all of a sudden, Tiny was in Samoa. So he left. He fled. And eventually, Donovan Flippo was pled out in the summertime, and was given 2 years of probation, 80 hours of community service. And then one thing that's pretty controversial, he was banned from all large rallies in Multnomah County for like 2 years. I don't care about any of it, because it's all I oppose what the DA its office does with most things. So, you know, like I was participating in this because, well, A, I had to later on, because you become not a victim, you become a witness of the state that's commanded to be there.
Subpoenable.
Yeah. Like I said, my objectives for even getting involved in the first place were to keep somebody out. So I don't really, like, but it does seem kind of unconstitutional to ban someone from political rallies. But, you know, whatever. But, yeah, so that was that. And then I just figured Tiny wasn't going to come back or something. But he did sometime later. And one other thing about the Donovan Flippo case was that there was an ICE contractor who paid his bail, who I then outed because I had in the court document, and when I searched the person's name, they came up both in an article where he outed himself as a ICE contractor. In an event, coincidentally, like right after I was assaulted, that got me really involved in the Occupy ICE camp, because I thought I was helping protect it one night from an attack from the Proud Boys, but then it was supposed to be this misunderstanding that it was like these Tesla employees, but then later on it was this person admitted in an article that they lied, so they were with Proud Boys. And when you searched his name, the funny thing was that he had a secret Facebook under the name John Wick, but he never changed the URL from his real name. So if you searched his name, it came up on his secret Facebook, where it's clear that he is a member of the Proud Boys. And then when the BBC did a documentary, I guess they filmed at his house even a little bit, and then he paid Donovan's bail. So when he was outed, he was fired. So that was cool. But yeah, so Tiny, all of a sudden, to my surprise, I think in like October, was picked up at the airport by federal marshals. He returned, and then he had a hearing that I went to. That was like, he clearly was not at that hearing. He was, you know, he turned it into like a Proud Boy press conference. Essentially, he had all his crew of failed dads and losers and chuds there, and they were kind of hijacked it and tried to, it was just a mess. So that's where things were at, and we were just kind of waiting. I was just waiting for this to be over, because, you know, this was 2018, June of 2018. You know, it's...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and, like, so much has happened since then. It's like, it was just, like, the case that would never end. And finally, today, I think it has.
And so, can you tell us a little about what happened this morning?
Yeah, so...
How much advance warning you were given of it?
I was given... Well, I knew it was coming. I didn't know that it was going to be this quick. I mean, like, I knew that he was supposed to have some sort of call or hearing or something last week. It got pushed ahead again, and the DA had informed me, or the ADA, Nathan Vasquez, had informed me that, like, so they were going to offer him essentially the same deal as Donovan, and put me in an awkward place, because, like I said, I oppose prison, I oppose the courts as it is, and how they do things. So there was no way I was going to advocate for more, even though I probably could have, especially because, I mean, like, comparatively, I mean, like, this person was the one that was definitely, like, admitted being part of the assault. They had all these cooperating people. And then also, the other thing is that, like, he fled the country, you know? So, you know, I mean, like, so, I don't know. But then he ended up, I think, I mean, essentially, aside from having to pay restitution for my medical bill, which is still unpaid, which is really high, he essentially got this, he actually kind of got a lighter deal than his co-defendant, so.
What was it that Donovan was, what was his plea deal again?
I mean, it's the same. They both have essentially the same deal, but I think Donovan had to do some a few days in prison. I mean, in jail.
Yeah, it was like a week or something.
Yeah, and he had some time served. But now, Tiny had to do that the other day, but that was not related. That was for the other thing, his other, like, probation violations. Like, the other month, he had to do, like, 10 days or 15 days or something. But it had nothing to do with ours. So, yeah, but it was just kind of interesting. I mean, like, so I'm not going to advocate for any more than that. I wish more sentences were, well, the whole system should be abolished, but you know, but I mean, I wish that they would have more sentencing like this as opposed to what normally happens, which is a lot more crueler. In particular, the wide disparity in how they have been aggressively pursuing anti-fascists who have been just resisting these people coming into our city and, you know, cause running amok. They have been aggressively going after those people with way worse, in particular on the last big rally there on, was it August 15th or August?
Yeah, and they, yeah, when they crossed the Hawthorne, yeah, Bridge and were
in
blocked.
The August there, one, yeah.
And they had all their people staged on the east, yeah, side of the,
mm-hmm,
river.
Yeah, that one that, like, was, yeah, with the express purpose of, like, bank, not bank rolling, what's the other thing? Bankrupting the city, like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, and all that, and, yeah, fighting the Antifa terror, whatever. Well, when one of those groups that was there, who is essentially, like, was founded by, like, actual, like, neo-Nazi boneheads from, like, the Hammerskins, this group, American Guard, when their bus drove through, people, you know, there was some sort of something that happened where the bus stopped and people, and someone was trying to, from the bus, was trying to hit people off the head with a hammer. And, an individual, ran up and, grabbed the hammer out of his hand and then eventually threw it back into the bus. And for that, that person is looking at a Measure 11 offense, like the serious time, was given, like, they had to pay like close to 60 grand to get out of jail, as opposed to Tiny, who actually fled the country and has no prior records. And also they have no cooperating victim, and they use testimony from people, like, people that are just, like, that weren't even there. And one person that was involved in my situation, Russell Schultz, who was the driver, who was never questioned with my thing, but the ADA told me specifically that they would never put that guy on the stand. Because there was some confusion on May Day before he was part of the attack on Cider Riot. I ran into him and he screamed at me saying that he was going to be a witness in my case when it was going to maybe go to trial. And I called the ADA and I was like, well, you're not putting him on, because there had been kind of a schism between him and the Proud Boys. So I was like, you're not putting him, like, up. And he was like, no, we would never. That guy's not credible. We would never put that guy up. And then they used him for his secondhand information about, he said at a party, he later on that day, he heard the guy that had the hammer talking about it being, but that same guy and another individual were recorded bragging about hitting people with the hammer, and one guy trying to stab people off the bus.
And so he's facing, like, This anti-fascist protester is facing years of prison.
Yeah, yeah, and he's no prior, you know. So when I'm frustrated with what I'm frustrated about with the verdict today is not so much Tiny getting off light. It's like just the disparity in which they've gone after people, because you know, Tiny also, like, you know, you can't and you shouldn't try people for crimes that aren't related to the situation or why you're there, you know. But the fact of the matter is, Tiny is, like I said earlier, has been involved in dozens of assaults, a bunch of which have been caught on film, a bunch of which he brags about, you know. So, and he was doing this for years here, and has not shown. Now today he showed, you know, to the judge, he gave some little spiel about some little redemption spiel. I don't really buy it. I think he was at a rally with Haley Adams just recently.
Haley Adams is a colleague of Joey Gibson.
Part of that whole milieu. And like, that's the thing. They were also like that group of people, and there's a bunch of them. There's like these, they're just really unstable. Just cranks and weirdos, and they always changing what they're they're just like, she and people like her and Joey are in, you know, like Andy No, and they're more, I feel like, grifters. They don't have any real actual ideological, or if they do, it's very weak and it's very malleable. They switch around a lot, and they're just sort of chaos agents. So I don't really buy his redemption. I mean, hey, if it was true, then it would all, you know, it would all be worth it. But I don't think that it is. But the judge was very much on that same tip today. She was like talking about empathy and people not getting their needs met, and that's why they commit violence, which is all great, like all stuff I definitely agreed with and stuff that I really try to hold firm to in my day-to-day life, whether it's professionally at work or just, you know, just with people I know. But I wish more people could get a judge like this, more people more deserving than Chiney. But I don't, like, you know, at the end of the day, I can't let my, like, spite or anger kind of override principles that I have in terms of how I feel about the justice system and stuff. And I also, at the end of the day, Chiney going to prison doesn't make... doesn't keep anybody safer, and also Chiney not going to prison doesn't make an anti-fascist who has to go to prison like any worse, other than that, like, it's just unfair. Mm-hmm. But like Chiney then going to prison them both going to prison doesn't make, I mean, that's not where people should focus. I mean, I understand people are angry and frustrated, and, you know, it's annoying in comparison, but I don't think that it's just not where I'm going to focus my energy. I the sentence I'm fine with. I just wish that it was, you know, that sort of same leniency would be granted to people that shouldn't even be in trouble to begin with. So,
Anything you'd like to add before we wrap up?
Yeah. I think that people need to be supported that are, you know, there's some cases coming up that, like, you know, on the anti-fascist side that are, you know, it's just egregious if these people have to go to, if any of these people I have to do any time or anything like that over, you know, protecting their community, as opposed to, you know, I mean, like I said, I support the light sentencing that happened today. I just want it applied to everybody.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I've been talking with Tim Ledwith. Thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Here dancing, all I You're listening to KBOO, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up is Preference with your illustrious host, Hedda.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The events committee will meet in January on Tuesday, the 21st at 5 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Not So Supernova on Saturday, January 18th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the All Saints Episcopal Church in Portland. Not So Supernova is a full-length one-woman play exploring the edges of motherhood and marriage with humor and depth. Again, that's Not So Supernova on Saturday, January 18th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the All Saints Episcopal Church, 4033